type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks very much for your answer.
Thank you.
And thanks for that question. We do have three remaining calls, and I don't think we have time for all of those. So we'll do St. Paul at Catherine's location. We'll do that next. And in Minneapolis and Chicago, we will have other question points, and we'll have you. We'll pick you up at that point. So to Catherine's location in St. Paul, the line is open. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hi, Andy. Could you elaborate a little more on that voluntary nature? This is Kathy Borbis in St. Paul.
Could you speak up, please? We can just barely hear you.
I can't quite hear you, Catherine.
Could you elaborate a little more on that voluntary nature, since so many things are mandated? And could you also comment on the grassroots approach versus the top-down, and how to, you know, what do you think about integrating them, or how, you know, what is your approach to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's this issue of providing people an opportunity to modify or locally adapt the situation. I look upon as you pay me now, or you pay me later. If you pay me now, it means I'm going to present the improvement to you and allow you to slow down that process of implementation so that you can modify or kick its tires or adapt it to your situation. If you don't do that, the studies would suggest you'll pay the system later. Basically, the system will pay significantly in terms of saying, well, people are simply following the rules rather than internalizing, or they're going to be sabotaging the process, or the innovation will simply die on the vine, like we started off in our initial discussion. So it seems to me that it's not an issue of saying, should I provide people an opportunity to adapt and locally fit an innovation to their local situation. They will, but they may be doing so, and if they don't have that opportunity, they probably will simply be adopting an innovation in bad faith, following the rules. I'm not responsible for this. I'm just doing what they told me to do. This, of course, is very much connected with the top-down versus bottom-up. To allow people to adapt the situation or a treatment to fit their local situation is kind of a bottom-up approach, or at least it's a negotiated approach. It says that from the outside or from some other level, here is a proposed program. Would you please study it and conduct a workshop or two in your local situation to see how and what parts of it might be useful in improving practice in your local situation or in your local clinic? That's not a top-down approach. A top-down approach would tend to say everyone will be adopting this particular approach or else, and then begin to apply coercive techniques and incentive techniques in order to get people to comply with a request by simply doing what the letter of the law says. In almost all innovations, in almost all improvement efforts, you will find there are extensive opportunities and needs for local adaptation, because no centralized unit nor a research team can possibly think about all of the particular and unique situations in which a program has to be implemented.
And thanks to St. Paul for that question. And just a reminder, at Renee's location in Minneapolis, we will pick you up, come back into the queue again when we start back to the another question session, and we'll go back to you, Andy. And just to let you know, we have about a total of 40 minutes left of the program.
Oh, very good. So we're doing pretty well then.
Correct.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, let's go on now to talking about organizational culture. Page 6 on the top. What I have listed here is the characteristics that enable an organization to develop a culture of innovation. And the six characteristics summarized here are the characteristics that Dr. William Coyne, who was Senior Vice President for Technology at 3M, spoke about and has written about in building a tradition of innovation. And certainly he has done that at 3M. And we've had an opportunity to trace that over time. His six basic principles, which seem, by the way, many studies of the culture of organizational innovation support Bill's six principles for creating this tradition of innovation. These studies show that a variety of factors motivate and enable the chance of innovation in organizations. And they deal with this notion of providing people direct and personal contact with the needs and opportunities, that there are rewards, that there are alternative resource pools, that there is cross-boundary communications and open information and methods for conflict resolution. So from that point of view, the whole argument is that normal people can and will innovate if enabling and motivating conditions are present. So what are those motivating and enabling conditions? Well, this is what Bill Coyne is speaking about. First, there needs to be vision. And he emphasizes, declare the importance of innovation or the improvement, then make it a part of the company's or the organization's self-image. Foresight. Find out where the technologies or the markets or the needs of healthcare are going, and identify articulated as well as unarticulated needs of patients, or of customers. So whereas people may articulate specific requests, truly important new innovations are often ones that cannot be articulated because they haven't thought of them yet. Stretch goals. To make quantum improvements, like, for example, at 3M, they ask all people that 30% of sales of products that were introduced in the past 4 years, that is the basis upon which they provide their expectations of how goals should be set. That 30% of sales come from products that were introduced within the past 4 years. Empowerment. Hire good people and trust them and delegate it. Responsibilities, provide them slack resources and get out of the way. You've heard of this before, and yet it is clearly the empowerment scenario that's crucial for, obviously, getting people to internalize an innovation and allowing them to locally adapt it to their situation. Communications. Open, extensive, exhaustive exchanges. According to some ground rules, though, in forums for sharing ideas. And maybe my observation in healthcare, in having observed a system of providers, hospitals, clinics, and a health plan try to integrate activities, is that while there's a lot of communication, it's a lot of bad blood. And the reason it's bad blood and that's created in a lot of emotional and, quite frankly, pathological conflict, is that there is not the forum, there aren't the rules of engagement for dialogue, for debate, for discussion. Maybe we need to spend much more time from an organization culture point of view, corporate culture point of view, to set forth the terms of engagement, as they often say, that allows people to debate, but only on grounds and on the basis of procedures that will respect and continue to respect the dignity of the individuals engaged in that process. And then finally, rewards and recognition. Innovation is an intensively human activity, Bill Coyne says. So emphasize recognition more than monetary rewards. That's an interesting point. At 3M, they do that. They emphasize recognition more than monetary rewards. And it's often thought that monetary rewards are so crucial. But my observation, especially in healthcare again, is that while money is necessary in order to bring bread on the table, I suspect that there are more important, more significant goals and ideals that most healthcare practitioners espouse, even though, let's face it, if they don't have an opportunity to adopt that, then money becomes the only thing. And they tend to become disengaged, don't they? Well, so going on from that, let's go down to talking about alternative models of healthcare. As we all know, this industry has been undergoing massive transformation as physicians and practices and hospitals and health insurance plans are merging or had been merging in the 1990s and now again disintegrating. And these changes have juxtaposed individuals with different professional and administrative values and colliding organizations with historically different cultural identities and practices. These alternative models of organizing that I have here on this slide capture, I think, some of the core distinct models, if you will, organizing models for healthcare. You know, it began on the far right with a community model, a benevolent group that serves the greater good of society because it's the right thing to do. And so based upon that, we had developed a missionary model, if you will, that provided knowledge and support for local needs. And the model continues to today. But it's been adopted also and expanded by the profession, the medical profession itself, which adopts a different way of thinking about this. It's a model that's kind of an exclusive association of physicians that advances knowledge and practice as a, in a medical specialty. And then here, the key elements for organizing are professional standards, collegial decisions, expert authority, community of practice, and so forth. The hospital system that emerged as a crucial part of the healthcare, quote, system, unquote, is another mode of organizing. It's the bureaucracy mode, a hierarchical structure designed to achieve system goals in the most efficient ways. And for that, we adopt the Weberian, Max Weber's principles of the division of labor and specialization and procedures and hierarchy and standardization. And finally, I guess the latest component, the latest new mental model on in the healthcare scene, that's pretty much emerged during the past 15 years, wouldn't you think, is the market model. That views healthcare as a commercial enterprise designed to compete for material gain in the market. And so the key elements for organizing is customer drivenness, competition, strategic advantage, material self-interest. You know, kind of the stuff that people say, my goodness, we have lost and sold the ship. And that's the way certainly many professionals and community people adopt. Well, why do I bring this up? I guess I bring this up to reflect, number one, that there is this pluralism, that there are these multiple competing models at place. And we are finding people with these four distinct mental models in a hybrid way, you know, almost every healthcare system. Each model is an internally consistent and equally legitimate basis for organizing key parts of the healthcare system. So a strong case can be made that each model is necessary for the long-run survival of healthcare, and that squelching any one of these models may hamper the adaptive capabilities of the healthcare system in the long run. So the trick is to find ways to respect and heedfully accommodate these pluralistic values, preferences, and ideologies. And accomplishing this trick will represent a tremendous leadership challenge. Well, if how might we incorporate and deal with this? And I think we're moving to, say, going to the top of page 7. My hunch is this, that change at a corporate system level will not be done through the typical managerial approach of unity of command, alliance to one strategic vision, and then incentives and alignment. Instead, it's more useful to think about strategic level change, system-wide change, in terms of a political process model. Much like illustrated here on the top of page 7, Donald Schoen, in his book Beyond the Stable State, and gosh, it's 30 years old plus, but it is a wonderful book that provides a useful description of what are the typical sequence of stages that unfold in order for public policies to become law or to become part of the structure that guides the society. Think of changes from a political point of view. And Schoen discusses the typical stages in which these new public policies or laws emerge. First, there is typically a disruptive event. That's shown in the bottom left-hand corner, threatening disruptive event. That threatens the social system and triggers a new appreciation of the problem or opportunity. I guess healthcare has got many of those opportunities right now, doesn't it? Especially such as errors and healthcare costs. In the second stage, ideas that are gestating in the peripheral areas of the system surface to the mainstream by their adherents. In other words, people are running around and have been developing solutions, but they haven't been given an opportunity to express them or to gain any public visibility until people are searching for solutions in response to the threatening events. But typically those solutions don't get much traction until stage three. Networks galvanize around them. The media give them catchy slogans, and Schoen says, and that propels them into public scrutiny and debate. But he says those ideas are not potent to change public policy within or outside of organizations until they win out in political debate and they are used to gain influence. So point five, then, is the winning ideas gain legitimacy, and all the rest are dropping off. And legitimacy is the power to change institutions. So point six, the idea gains, and the currency of an idea remains for only as long as it addresses critical problems, or the administrative regime remains in power. Now, the implication of Schoen's model, I propose, is that the adoption of innovations in most complex, pluralistic organizations, like healthcare, requires mobilizing a political campaign to push and ride those ideas into good currency. And I think most of healthcare people, including physicians and doctors and administrators, abhor the thought of politics. Well, that's certainly true in terms of thinking about politics in the nefarious everyday kind of language that we use. But if we think about politics in terms of addressing the needs of the polity and of the fact that there are legitimate competing points of view, logics of organizing, and powerful interest groups that must be continued and will continue, then we can't be thinking about the traditional management approach of trying to get everyone to fall in line with one point of view. It just won't work. And efforts to do so usually result in squelching critical points of view or mental models of the system. The real challenge, it seems to me, of leadership is to heedfully accommodate these divergent points of view, and to find not just middle ground, but to find new synthesis that provides sparks of creative solutions to problems in a political, through some kind of a political process. I'll go on to a couple more points, which is to say, let's go on to a larger view, an augmented view of the healthcare industry on the bottom of page 7. My sense is that discussions of innovation, diffusion, and adoption tend to overemphasize the proprietary behavior of private firms and providers of healthcare. And we found that the emergence of a larger industry to support the commercialization of a technology or an innovation really is a collective achievement. And there are many more points that need to be considered in order to develop a larger view of an augmented view of most innovations. Think about the healthcare system. Well, in terms of the bottom part of that slide, you can see proprietary activities, product development, business functions, resource channels. That's what you see going on within most healthcare provider organizations. And they adopt and rely upon some common goods as available from the resource endowments area. Knowledge of healthcare and scientific and technological advances, financing and assurance arrangements, the creation of competent training and accreditation of medical specialties. Those are crucial factors, resources, that any healthcare provider needs in order to make advancements. So also on the right side is the market consumption perhaps the lack of a informed market of healthcare consumers is the largest hurdle that impacts healthcare innovations. The cultural norms, the market creation of demand, informed understanding are crucial. And then finally, there's institutional arrangements. These are the roles for government, but also other professional associations that establish legitimation and laws and regulations and standards for the provision of various care. So now when you start thinking about improvements, improvements seldom are contained, or healthcare innovations, they're seldom contained within the confines or the boundaries of a given organization. They typically transcend many different organizations and cut across public and private sectors. And these different components of this industry are interdependent. Initiatives can help and hinder each other. For example, in building informed consumers on the right-hand side is obviously jeopardized when legislated guidelines are set up here in terms of laws and regulations that are at odds with basic scientific advances that are learned from the left-hand side. Now, this really provides, it seems to me, a different way of thinking about who is responsible and what roles people play in the development of innovations. As suggested, it seems to me one point might be that organizations that run in packs are going to be more successful than those who try to go it alone to establish the infrastructure that's needed to commercialize or to diffuse an innovation. By running in packs, I mean it's analogous to a bicycle race, you know, where participants lead, learn to cue their pace in the strategy of racing with one another, and they take turns breaking wind resistance while running in the pack until the ending sprint. And so running in packs enables, but it certainly doesn't assure, that the race will be successful, but it does provide most racers to get to the pack faster and perhaps even break a record. Well, I think that organizations, healthcare managers, need to learn to run in packs, simultaneously cooperating and competing with one another to build various components of this healthcare system. For as the top of the next page, the slide in the top of page 8 suggests, there are some strategic questions that we need to be thinking about. From a macro point of view, we should be thinking about, well, what's retarding, what's hindering progress in the development and diffusion of an innovation? Now we're going back to that the shape of the S-shaped curve that we talked about at the very beginning. And the shape of that curve and the steepness of that curve, I would argue, is largely a function of knowing what components of this infrastructure are serving as bottlenecks to the advancement and the diffusion of the innovation. The second kind of key question we need to ask is, who is involved in developing each of these components? Many different public and private sectors actors have important roles to play. And the third point is, what components of that infrastructure is your organization or your firm playing? That's a strategic choice. When you don't have that larger picture in mind of the infrastructure or the augmented industry or the larger interorganizational field in which these innovations go on, an organization often performs activities by default. But as my bottom point indicates, the way a firm or an organization or a group of organizations decides that question has strategic implications. Like they say, the world is run by those who show up, and it usually favors the ones who are involved and are politically savvy. I have a slide on the overall dynamic cycle of the innovation journey that suggests that whenever we're thinking about the process of innovation, it seldom, if ever, follows a linear sequence of development from idea creation to its development, testing, prototype, and then implementation. Instead, it's an ongoing cycle. And so when we were talking about various, and the particular overall dynamic cycle of the innovation journey that I have here is the cycle which is the central theme of our book on managing the innovation journey that my co-authors and I published in 1999 with Oxford University Press. But the issue that I would like to emphasize here is not only is this a nonlinear dynamic cycle rather than a linear cycle, and second, when you go through this cycle, there are periods where resources and unit restructurings occur that allow for exploration and divergent behavior, and there are constraints that lead the process back toward more a convergent behavior along the lines described in the chart. The basic conclusion, though, from that is a couple of concluding comments, which we can discuss further. But the basic conclusion is that the innovation journey is not sequential, nor is it orderly, nor is it random. Instead, it is a nonlinear dynamic cycle of divergent and convergent activities that repeat over time and across levels if certain enabling and constraining conditions are present. And the implications for me that I like to suggest is that innovation is not something you can control. Rather, you go with the flow. You cannot control it, but you can learn to maneuver it. I think of it much like a metaphor of a river, an uncharted river, where to think about the adoption of new practices, innovative practices, that you haven't had before. People are basically going down an uncharted river. They don't know when they are going to go through the rapids and the falls versus the calm and easy areas. The obvious point, though, is that people who are traveling down a river don't control the river. Instead, they learn to maneuver the journey by swimming or by rafting or whatever is necessary. The second point is that enabling and constraining factors set the scope of the innovation. How much time, how much investment, what kind of structure is crucial to influencing the extent to which an innovation can expand. And then the third thing is that if it is a cycle of divergent and convergent behavior, we have to begin to develop more ambidextrous management skills. Most of us have been trained very well in our Masters of Healthcare Administration programs to manage the right side, convergent behavior. Few of us have had the experience, and in fact, we abhor the divergent behavior on the left side. Yet, it's a necessary part of the ongoing cycle. So in conclusion, as the last chart suggests, what can entrepreneurs do to increase the diffusion and the adoption of innovations? Well, I've mentioned number one, design the characteristics of the innovation to facilitate adoption. Second, address resistance to change on the part of people. It is not pathological, not invented here, syndrome behavior. Third, understand how and why people comply with requests. If we understand that, we can at least manipulate the likelihood of putting people in a positive frame to respond to a request. Four, recognize that healthcare organizations are complex and pluralistic, and so given that, we need to mobilize the political campaigns that are needed to gain good currency for our ideas system-wide. And in that process, obviously create and pay attention to creating an organizational culture that enables innovation. That, by the way, doesn't happen by going off on a weekend retreat and saying we're going to tweak some dials and things for the organization. Instead, it's better to think about an organization culture is created project by project, program by program, brick by brick, or drop by drop. That is, with each potential opportunity for innovation and how it is managed in how each improvement is managed, one builds a culture that enables innovation. And finally, none of us can do it alone. None of us has the resources or the competency to work this all out. And so that is true both within our system as well as outside of our system. So we need to learn to run in packs rather than go it alone. Well, I'm open for further questions.
Very good. And as you did before, all you have to do is press 1 to get into the queue and on your touchtone pad, and a pound key will take you out. And if you were waiting on a question before and we didn't get to you, you'll need to re-enter the queue. So pressing 1 will do that. And Andy, while we're waiting for those to come in, we did have one email question from Chandra's location in Minneapolis.
Okay.
And that came in, and it is, how would you recommend organizing a system-based team around a desired system innovation to accommodate adaptation and spread over/across multiple sites?
Well, now it's an interesting point. I'm thinking of this slide, and let me go to that slide if I can find it. And it is the slide on the top of page 4. Adoption processes vary when the decision unit is an individual, change is implemented in depth and breadth, change is externally mandated, and the system is pluralistic. All right, so we've talked about some of these things, but this question deals with that. If in system-wide change, my assumption is the question deals with how do I replicate an innovation, let's say, from one clinic to the next, to the next, to the next of a large healthcare system. And that's the kind of question that really does deal with diffusion. And it's the kind of question that deals with the question of how can I, on the one hand, communicate and get people to say yes, comply with requests of the core idea of an innovation or a change or an improvement program, and yet, on the other hand, allow them, each site, to have the opportunity to locally adapt it, to modify it, to fit their situation, while yet maintaining the integrity or the spirit of the innovation or improvement effort. That's what I would focus on. I'm not sure if I've answered your question.
Well, if not,
that's the way I'm thinking about it.
Perhaps they can come in via the voice queue if they want a little more detail on that.
Great.
We can go next to Minneapolis, Minnesota at Renee's location. The line is open. Go ahead with your question. And just so you know, we have a little bit more than 10 minutes remaining.
Great.
Thank you. My question takes us back to the slide at the top of page 5. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about reciprocity. Do you have some examples of what that might be?
Ah, yes. Reciprocity is as simple as saying, gosh, you look happy and wonderful today. By the way, would you be willing to help me do something? So reciprocity is simply a compliment before making a request. It could also be, but more generally, it is this very basic norm that we've all grown up with. We've all been trained to always acknowledge a gift with a thank you. Always we feel obliged to reciprocate in kind. When someone gives you something, you give something in return. This doesn't just have to be gifts. More importantly, I think in healthcare, it is acknowledgement. If I respect you, I increase the likelihood that you might respect me. And if you can build that mutually respectful relationship before we enter into a debate about something, that would help us a great deal, wouldn't it? Does that address your question?
Yes, thank you.
Great, thank you.
And thanks to Minneapolis for that question. Next to Denver, Colorado at Anna's location, the line is open. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I guess my question is really around this notion of the core idea of an innovation, and perhaps this question reflects the mindset of an innovator who doesn't want to see his or her idea changed. But how much customization, how do you know when customization has kind of gone too far or it's too much? Have you lost the idea, the original core idea? Are there boundaries, or do you set boundaries within which people can customize? I'd be curious in your reaction to that.
wonderful questions, which, you know, you can only answer, I guess, in theory, in general, and the specifics will determine the law of the situation. That is a specific innovation. My sense is this. It comes down to trust, doesn't it? That is to say, you are an innovator or you're part of a healthcare system improvement effort, and you have worked dearly, hard, years in developing a program. You've considered all the pros and cons and situations, and as a result, you have good reasons to emphasize each element of the program. And you have good reasons for concerns when any element of the program is being violated or not being introduced. Well, the crucial issue I think that we need to respect here is to say, yes, that is probably true in the context or situation in which you, as an innovator of a team, have experienced. What I think we're becoming more sensitive to is how situation and culture blind we tend to be with regard to knowledge of innovations or knowledge in general. We somehow assume that procedures and issues cut across and apply into many different settings and contexts. And in fact, they apply in a very limited context. And the thing that bothers or makes implementation so difficult is that principles that were and seem to work well in one context simply do not work well in other contexts because they violate either local custom or habits or laws or conventions or practices or even ethnic affiliations. So where I come out on this issue is it depends upon how much the people in the local organizations and the local settings of an innovation are trusted.
Thank you.
Does that fit with your thinking?
Yes, I think you've hit on some key points for us here.
Okay.
And thanks to Denver for that. We have one call at this point, so we and have about 5 or 6 minutes left. So
great.
If anyone else would like to, all you have to do is press 1. That'll bring you into the queue. But we'll take that next call. That would be Long Beach, California at Robin's location. The line is open. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a question, and it has to do with about just the organization that we're dealing with in general and your recommendations. My observation is that, you know, we kind of talk about the two extremes. One, that you have a very bureaucracy where it's very top-down, and then you also are trying to encourage a kind of more pluralistic where things are also coming up. What do you recommend when the system is so strongly bureaucratic and that in general the whole kind of plurocratic approach has been quite discouraged, and how would you expect and if there are the things of plurocracy, it's kind of isolated and kind of in various forms of infancy. How would you suggest organizations like that go about addressing that particular issue?
Do you want me to give you an empirical answer based upon studies in other industries?
That would any answer would be great.
I hate to say this, but studies in other industries, such as mini, what happened to the companies that were the mini computers that were eroded by and had to totally transform themselves either as micro into microcomputer, personal computer companies, or mainframe. And the answer is the vast majority of those large companies that were very strong in mini computers were not able to make the transformation to these different markets. And so they went out of business. The second is that in those cases where there were these strong embedded organizations with a very strong and unidirectional, if you will, leadership, that they had to be replaced. Not only the top leader, but the entire executive team, in order for those companies to make a successful transition. Wow, that's kind of hard to take, isn't it? But that's what the empirical data suggests. In fact, in those studies, it was the truly special organizations that maintained their executive and leadership team and also made a transformation. In those organizations, they had a special capability of being able to tolerate and work through these divergent points of view, these opposing points of view. One of them, for example, Andy Grove at Intel, made a wonderful analogy of the problem and the transformation that Intel had to go in working through the technological discontinuities that it had to work through in its history. And Grove said that the way we did it is, instead of waiting for us to be replaced, what we did is we, in effect, metaphorically, walked out the door of the company and walked back in with a totally different process. I mean, that's quite remarkable. It requires a tremendous ability for learning, for adaptability, for change, and for that matter, letting go of old traditional procedures.
Do you have any examples in the healthcare industry? Because I know you hear a lot of examples in the high-tech industries, but it
yeah.
does seem like in healthcare, the general direction actually is going from a plurocratic where it's a lot of decisions were made very locally, but the overall trend in all of healthcare as an industry seems to be going the other way. And I guess just comments on that. That's my observation.
Yep. And Andy, I need to share that you have about a minute and a half at the most for
oh.
that answer.
Thank you. Well, I guess I have just a very quick observation. Number one, it seems to me that this represents one of the most significant challenges for leadership and management of healthcare systems, the ability to deal with, in a constructive way, with opposing pluralistic interests. Number two, it seems to me that with the disintegration of efforts at managed healthcare that combined clinics and hospitals and health plans into one vertically integrated system or control system, that has not been working, which suggests that the limits of pluralism are exceeding the capability of leadership. So it represents a truly significant challenge.
Thank you very much. And Marie, any closing comments from you?
All right, thank you. I want to thank you, Andy, for your presentation and for being here with us today. I think you've set us on a really fantastic course for the rest of our conversations together as we complete the call to action. Let me just remind everyone that refer to the instructions that are in your packet, and we want to encourage further discussion beyond this call on qualityhealthcare.org and on the discussion page that's been set up there. And Andy will be available to answer questions and continue this discussion with you, so I'd like you to take advantage of that. And also, as we mentioned at the top of the call, to remember to complete your evaluation of the call, and you have until a month from now for this particular call to complete those evaluations. So once again, thank you, Andy, and thanks, everyone, for being here. And Kirk, I guess you can wind it up then.
Very good. Thank you, Marie.
Thank you, everyone. I really appreciated the opportunity.
That concludes today's program, Setting the Context for Change and Spread, brought to you by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and presented by Dr. Andrew Vandeven and moderated for the IHI by Marie Schall. And please remember to take care of your evaluation forms. Your comments and suggestions are helpful as they help us provide you with future quality programming. Today's program is copyright 2003 by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, all rights reserved. Thanks for joining us for this program, and enjoy the rest of your day. You may disconnect now.